before that, but I had never seen it, you know, live. And, you know, I mean, I hang around with, you know, scientists and mathematicians, and, you know, and as you mentioned in your introduction, you know, evolution is just pretty much unquestioned and, you know, just accepted in that environment. So this was something kind of new to me. And I just found it very interesting. And I, just, you know, while I was at the conference, I just struck up conversations with people just in an informal way. And anyway, that's how I got started. And then just over the years, I went to more and more of these conferences, sometimes big multi-day conferences, sometimes just little evening sessions at a local church. And I had more and more conversations. And after about, you know, good 7 or 8 years of this, I had enough stories and enough experience that I felt I could paint a, you know, a more realistic picture of what was going on. Because there are certainly plenty of books about evolution and creationism, but most of them are written by scientists. And they're written really with the idea of just explaining the science, you know, of it. And you know, and scientists, you know, tend to get a little impatient, you know, with creationists. So I thought I could paint a little more, you know, write a little bit more about the human side, you know, of creationism based on my personal experiences and really explain what exactly are the issues. Like, why is, you know, evolution considered so sensitive, for so many people? Because like you mentioned in your introduction, there are certainly plenty of Christians who have no trouble accepting evolution. So it's not Christianity in general that has a problem with evolution. It's particular, you know, strains of thought within, Christianity. So anyway, you know, I decided I had something, you know, something to say that hadn't been said before, and that's why I decided to write the book.
In the United States, mm-hmm. amidst the general population, mm-hmm. debate still rages as to whether evolution or creation is the correct narrative of biological origins. Mm-hmm. As you said, for scientists, for the most part, it's settled. Now, there are scientists who do not hold, but they're in a very distinct minority, you could say. Mm-hmm. Why would you say does this debate persist in the general population when for most scientists, it's long been settled in favor of evolution?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can certainly, I mean, you know, you can find an occasional scientist, you know, who will challenge it. And you know, culturally, college professors are kind of notorious for believing, you know, strange things. So, I mean, I can show you examples of people with PhDs who believe in alien abductions and all sorts of, you know, strange things. But it certainly is a very small minority. And I think it's a couple of things. Partly it's just simple ignorance. I mean, just to be blunt. I think people have some strange ideas about what evolution actually says. I think they picture things like dogs turning into cats or birds hatching out of lizard eggs or, you know, things like that. So part of it is I think in a lot of cases people just really don't understand what the theory says. But the other and more serious reason is that it really does challenge certain aspects, you know, of Christian, you know, thinking. It certainly challenges a literal interpretation of, you know, the creation story in Genesis. It certainly does that. But I don't think even that is really the main issue. I think people have a problem with the idea that evolution seems to downplay the importance of humanity in creation. Even leaving aside the minutia of, you know, the 6-day creation and Eve being created from Adam's rib, leaving aside those details, the theme of the story is that, you know, human beings are the reason for creation. You know, we are the pinnacle of creation. And evolution comes along and says, well, no, we're just one more species among others, and it was just a long line of historical accidents that led to human beings appearing. And I think a lot of people find that to be a bitter pill to swallow. And then there are a few related issues. There are also things like the evolutionary process is based on natural selection, which tends to be kind of wasteful and violent. And it says, basically, the theme of natural selection is anything that allows you to insert your genes into the next generation will be rewarded. So it's very violent and very bloody and very amoral. You know, any sense of moral decency that you have, don't try to apply that to the evolutionary process.
Kind of like law and sausages.
Yeah, exactly like that. And so it's a variation on the old problem of evil. It's that, you know, would a just and loving God really use this kind of, you know, bloody mechanism to do his creating when presumably he could have, you know, created, you know, ex nihilo, you know, all at once, you know, the way the Bible says he did. And then still another issue is that there's this thing called the argument from design, which is basically just the idea that, you know, like if you see a pocket watch, you know immediately it was designed, you know, by a person. You don't say, oh, that was just, you know, natural forces that brought this pocket watch together. And, you know, in the early 1800s, a fellow named William Paley wrote a very famous book where he said, well, look, you know, the kind of machines that you have in your city, like an eye is so much more impressive than a telescope. And yet if a telescope was obviously, you know, designed, then why, you know, then no less so for the eye. And that was a pretty good argument, actually, for his time. That was, I think, 1802 when he published that. And that was convincing to most scientists at the time. And then Darwin came along and showed that that was wrong, that actually you could explain that by natural, you know, means. So that kind of killed this very effective argument, you know.
And the argument that Darwin made essentially was that you could do it, But what you're not accounting for is that it would take a really, really long time.
Yeah. So the basic idea is that very complex systems evolve gradually, just step by step, you know, each step being a little improvement on the one before. So this, so it's just the nature of the beast that it takes a long time, you know, for this to happen. But the point is it was a viable explanation. And so this is another issue that people have with evolution, is that it kind of kills this argument. And it's not that Christianity requires this argument to be correct. It's just that it has a tendency to make God seem really far away. It's that if you had this idea that God created people, you know, directly, and then you try to change that to, well, God, you know, set in motion the Big Bang, which billions of years later, after, you know, eons of bloody natural selection led to human beings, it's a bit of a blow. So you have all these individual things that contradicts the Bible, or, well, contradicts one interpretation of the Bible. It kind of refutes the argument from design. It raises issues about the argument from evil, and it tends to downplay human significance. Kind of all of this together is a little too much to take, you know, for some people.
What did you learn from your time among creationists, and how did that experience both confirm and shatter your expectations?
Right. Well, so there's some of both, as I describe in the book. In some cases, you know, just to be perfectly blunt, you know, the stereotype that you often hear, there is quite a lot of basis for that. So one thing I found was generally there was a, you know, quite a lot of ignorance just about what the science says. I mean, I had a lot of times where people would just parrot scientific arguments to me, that really just didn't make any sense. My favorite examples, as I describe in the book, is periodically, they often use mathematical arguments, from probability theory and information theory. And of course, these are, you know, subjects I specialize in. And on a number of occasions, I had, you know, people trying to explain probability theory, you know, to me. And, you know, and that's a subject where I really do speak with some confidence. And it was just, they just flat didn't know what they were talking about. So there is certainly a lot of ignorance. And more than that, a lot of insularity. There's a tendency that they kind of only talk to each other. So you go to one of these conferences and everyone is repeating these really misinformed, you know, talking points. And I was the only one there, you know, offering any kind of counterpoint. And I don't think they had even ever met anyone, you know, like me before. When they found that I was an atheist, that was, oh my goodness, that was, you know, they read about people like me. So to that regard, my expectations were confirmed that, I mean, just when it comes, you know, at one level, this is just a scientific question. And I think all the really good arguments are on the side of evolution. But where I was, surprised was how graciously and how kindly I was, you know, treated at these conferences. It rarely happened, although it did happen occasionally, but it very rarely happened that I was treated rudely or that I was yelled at or called names or anything like that. In fact, usually, you know, the way I would do this, when I would go to a conference, I wouldn't make a pest of myself, but usually after the talk, there'd be a question and answer period. So I would just get up to the microphone and ask I would ask a question that would leave no doubt where I stood, you know, on these questions. But then I didn't, you know, I didn't heckle or stay at the microphone. I would just sit down. And what I found is, you know, pretty much every time I would have a whole crowd of people around me afterwards asking me questions and, you know, asking for more information. And so that was a bit of a surprise, you know, this idea that they were all just a bunch of, you know, fire breathers, you know, who were just going to...
Fire breathers or mouth breathers.
Or mouth breathers, for that matter, yeah. And that I really didn't find. They, you know, for the most part, they couldn't have been, you know, more polite, you know, and more gracious toward me. And, you know, and to be honest, I don't know if a creationist attending an atheist conference, because I've been to a few atheist conferences too, I don't know if they would have been treated as politely as I was treated. So I do give them credit for that. I was, you know, for the most part, I was treated very politely. So that was probably the biggest surprise that I had.
Well, I don't know if Sean Pittman was at any of the events you attended, mm-hmm. But he's the author of a book called Turtles All the Way Down. And Sean Pittman is a pathologist, a medical pathologist based in California. And Sean, what's your book about?
Well, my book is about my experiences with evolutionists, and I try not to be insular myself. I agree that most creationists I've run into and most creationists I've talked to, and since I grew up in the creationist community, my father's a pastor, are not very well informed. I agree with Jason 100% on this, and I had nobody really to effectively answer my questions growing up, and so even through medical school, I asked these same questions, you know, what's the limit of Darwinian evolution? Why can't you tell me where the limits are if you're so convinced that it's wrong? And then I went off into the Army, and it's kind of my first time outside of the Christian ghetto or Adventist ghetto, so to speak, and they couldn't answer, I couldn't answer their questions. A lot of people came to me with questions about science and evolution. They're like, how can you possibly be a Christian and accept the standard interpretation of the Bible and still be credible as a scientist? And it really shook me because I had no good answers. And so I decided I'd have to, if anybody could explain it to me, I'd have to figure it out for myself. And so I started doing research on my own to see if I could find any limits to the Darwinian mechanism. And so that's kind of where what my book is about, is what I think I've discovered about the limits of and potential of the evolutionary mechanism, and what it means for me. And so I thought I'd write it down and put it on a website and then make a short book out of it.
Sean, why did you write this book?
Because I really never intended to go around and talk much about these ideas. They were more personal ideas, just for me to figure out for myself. But then somebody said, well, you know, when I started talking to people, they said, you should put it on a website. So I finally eventually started putting my ideas like personal notes, but I publish them on a website. And so then after that, I started getting asked to go around and do a lot of talks and lectures, even at some public schools on this. And then people started to ask me if I had a book, and I never had a book to summarize some of these things. And so I decided to go ahead and try to write one.
Sean, I asked you to be part of this program because you and I are, first of all, part of the same denomination. We're both Seventh-day Adventists. And Seventh-day Adventists are one of those denominations, Christian denominations, that still hold to a literal, narrative around creation. We hold that the Bible is literally true in this regard. In fact, right now, our denomination is actually going through the process of strengthening its statement around creation, what we call Doctrine Number 6 of our 28 Fundamental Beliefs. So I was very interested in specifically a Seventh-day Adventist because I had questions of my own, but am not so immersed in this subject that I felt that I could respond to an evolutionary critique or these issues. So I was very glad when I found out about your work and about your book and about your website, detectingdesign.com. And I asked you to be part of this conversation. You went and bought a copy of Jason's book. I didn't have to send one to you. You seemed very eager to get it. And then you read it. And then, what was your response? I remember we talked about this. What was your response to the book after you had read it?
Oh, I really enjoyed the book. I read it in one sitting. I kind of couldn't put it down. I think it's an excellent book. The title is kind of funny for me because among the creationists, it's like, well, you know, it's kind of like Jane Goodall among the apes, you know? So what's this book about? So when I started reading it, though, I found that I agreed with lots of it. Maybe 85% of the book I agree with. It's been very similar to my own experience with creationists. I think most general creationists are not very well informed at all. But it's also true for most general evolutionists on the street that you just walk up and meet. Most evolutionists are not very well informed about evolution either, and their arguments aren't very good about evolution either. And so I found the book very interesting from somebody who had experienced very similar things to what I've experienced.
You know, when you shared it with me, I responded. I said I had the same response. Very early in the book, right in the preface on page 8, Jason says, "I do not agree that evolution and Christianity can easily coexist," which I thought was just a tremendous thing to say very early in the book.
Yeah, I agree with Jason on that. Same with Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins says, you know, Christianity doesn't make any sense. It's not rational if you accept evolution, and I agree with that. For me, it's not so much atheistic evolutionists. I think atheistic evolutionists like Richard Dawkins and Jason are very logical in their approach. If I accepted evolution, I would go down the same path, I'm sure. And so for me, Christianity, it either stands or falls based on evolution. It doesn't make any rational sense that you'd have effectively an evil God creating life, and you might be able to believe in a God of some kind, but certainly not the Christian God as described in the Bible. That just completely undermines that, because evolution, as Jason just described for you, is an evil process.
So you're one of those Christians who says this attempt to merge the views and say, well, we can be Christians and believe in evolution, as even many denominations do. You say that's illegitimate and that does not work.
Well, I think you can believe in God and evolution, some kind of God, but certainly not a benevolent Christian-style God. You might be able to believe in a Hindu or some Eastern mysticism sort of God, but the Christian God is described in the Bible. He feels pain when he sees a sparrow fall wounded to the ground, and he even complains when animals suffer in the Bible and things like that. It's just not consistent with the Christian view of a benevolent God.
Then let me ask you, because you had such a favorable impression of the book, and you said you agree with 85% of it, with what do you disagree?
I think I can guess which part he disagrees with.
Well, in the opening flyer for the book, the kind of the advertisement for the book, it says, you know, especially when people wander into his own field, mathematics, you know, then they get into big trouble. But throughout the whole book, Jason doesn't really talk about mathematics or the mathematical basis or the statistical basis for why the mechanism, random mutations, natural selection, can actually do what he claims it did. Most of the time in the book, he gives examples of evolution in action or even just stories of things that are assumed to have evolved by this mechanism based on fossil record or even real-life examples. He gives several real-life examples of evolution in action, but mostly dealing with like single protein enzymes, antifreeze proteins, things like that. And when he gets to more complex systems, like, you know, bacterial flagellum or the human eye or even higher level systems, he doesn't really detail how the mechanism is supposed to cross what I think are non-beneficial or neutral gaps within what I call sequence space. In other words, I believe all the examples he lists are real examples of evolution in action. I believe evolution happens, but only on low levels of what I call functional complexity. And specifically in his chapter where he talks about information systems and the difference between Shannon information and meaningful complexity, he says basically that science cannot deal with meaningful information because there's no real scientific definition for meaningful information. And with that, I disagree with him. I think that science can deal with meaningful information and that the concept can be scientifically defined and studied in a falsifiable manner.
Okay, may I jump in?
Yes, please.
Okay, so just a couple of responses to a number of things that have been said. On the subject of evolution of Christianity, it is true that I am myself, very skeptical of Christianity and also skeptical of attempts to reconcile evolution and Christianity. I do want it to be clear, though, that that's not some sort of, you know, straightforward logical inference. In other words, it's not evolution is true, therefore Christianity is false. And as you mentioned, Harry, in your introduction, there's certainly no shortage of very, you know, very fine scholars who defend the compatibility of Christianity and evolution. Sean, in your book, you refer to Ken Miller and Francis Collins. I think you refer to them as social Christians. I think that's not fair. I mean, these are, you know, full-blooded, in many cases, evangelical Christians. Francis Collins is an evangelical. Ken Miller is a Roman Catholic. But they consider themselves Christians, and they defend the creeds and all the rest. So I do want it to be clear that there is, you know, even though I guess Sean and I tend to agree on this one, there is another side to this, and there are ways of, you know, these problems that we're pointing out, the general savagery of the evolutionary process, or the fact that humans seem to be an afterthought in the evolutionary process. There are some very interesting, very sophisticated arguments, some of which I describe in the book, giving my best attempt to give the other side. So anyway, I just wanted to be clear that there is another side to that, and there are some very eloquent, very devout Christians who not only embrace, not only accept evolution, but actually embrace it. Now, this issue about natural selection, we talked about the mechanism of evolution being natural selection. I do want to point out first, before I respond to Sean's argument, so we're clear about the nature of my book. My book is not really about the evidence for evolution. You know, there are a lot of very good books that present that. I discuss, you know, little items here and there as they're relevant, but really my book is more about cultural beliefs, and I get into some of the religious issues and some of the history of it, and I do discuss some science, but it's not primarily that. So the fact that I didn't go into that level of detail about describing protein sequences and doing very detailed calculations, it just wasn't that kind of book, and we need someone better trained in biology to really do it at that level. Now, as to the question of whether natural selection can craft complex systems,
And just to interrupt you, this seems to be part of the argument that even many Christians make, that evolution is sufficient for explaining what's called microevolution,
right?
But not, in other words, natural selection is for microevolution, but not macroevolution. So you can get maybe the change in the length of a finger, but you're not going to get a new kind of being or organism from.
Yeah, and I think you know I think that whole argument is fundamentally flawed. The idea that natural selection can cause small changes. Well, the fact that natural selection can cause small changes, that's just an observational fact. I mean, that's not controversial at all. If you try to say, well, you know, maybe there's some threshold of complexity beyond which it can't go, no one's ever been successful in actually giving a good argument for that. Because the fact is, if you can get a small level of complexity, in a relatively short period of time, there's certainly no theoretical reason why you can't get larger levels of complexity over large periods of time. So you're not going to be able to do it from your armchair, like some of the intelligent design proponents do, like people like William Dembski or Michael Behe. More to the point, you say I didn't go into the mathematical calculations of it. That's because I don't think it's fundamentally a mathematical issue. I don't think mathematics actually has a whole lot to contribute to the question of whether natural selection can craft complex systems, because there's just no way to do a meaningful probability calculation, to tell you one way or the other. What I would point out is that we can certainly see that natural selection on a small scale, can construct even functional systems, even multi-part functional systems, and we can certainly do simulations of it as sort of a proof of concept. But in the long haul, if you say like, how do we know that the blood clotting cascade or the bacterial flagellum or the human eye? I would say in general, one big piece of evidence is that all of these systems look very bad from a design perspective. They look like systems that were designed by a haphazard process. And when scientists take that approach, when they look at these complex systems from the perspective of saying that these were the products of evolution, they're able to generate testable hypotheses that they then use to learn new things about these systems. And I think this discussion get very abstract very quickly, so I would like to make just a very practical point, which is that for professional scientists, professional biologists and anatomists and geneticists and embryologists and paleontologists, for them, evolution is not an abstract issue. It's not a matter of doing abstract calculations. It's not a matter of talking about worldviews. It's really much more practical than that. They have to go into the laboratory, and get results. And so for me as an outsider to the field, I am not a biologist. But when I talk to biologists, they tell me all the time about how they use evolution to get results in their work. And energy companies, when they hire geologists, they don't hire young Earth geologists, right? They hire old Earth geologists because for them it really matters whether they get the right answer or not. And paleontologists use evolution in old Earth geology, and I can go down the list. I mean, in every science, they get good results with these subjects. So I always get a little suspicious when someone starts making hand-wavy arguments about some threshold of complexity. Well, I'm sorry. I mean, if the physical evidence points strongly to the conclusion that something happened, and then some abstract mathematical model says it couldn't happen, it's the model that's at fault. And I'll stop there.
Sean, I really want to hear your response. What we're going to do is we're going to take a short break, about 2 minutes, 2 minutes or so, and then we're going to be back and hear what your response to what Jason has just said is. You're listening to Nonfiction. My name is Harry Allen, and this is the magazine of the Arts, Ideas, and Fact. And our discussion today is about creation versus evolution. And I'm sure that you can hear it's all firing. So we'll be back right after this.
Hi, Paul Fisher from WBAI then and WBAI now. Tired of pesky programs interrupting our fascinating fundraising drives? No problem. Don't touch that dial. We can sell you conspiracies and miracle cures till the sun goes supernova. Or you can help WBAI again become a station known for programs, not just products. How? Thought you'd never ask. Become a BAI buddy. That's a minimum $10 a month donation for each of the next 12 months. Help end the heartbreak of psoriasis cures and other lotions, potions, and nostrums sold on the radio by sending us money to make radio. Go to WBAI.org, our website, and become a BAI buddy. Well, I don't know if I'm walking on solid
ground. Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall.
We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a Big Bang.
Hey! Since the dawn of man is really not that long, as every galaxy. galaxy was formed in less time than it takes to sing this song. A fraction of a second and the elements were made. The bipeds stood up straight, the dinosaurs all met their fate. They tried to leap, but they were late and they all died.
They closed their asses off the oceans in Pangaea. See, a wooden bar to be a set in motion by the same Big Bang. It all started with a Big Bang. It's expanding ever outward, but one day it will pause and start to go the other way.
Collapsing ever inward, we won't be here, it won't be heard. Our best and brightest figure, the guild, they got even bigger bang.
Australopithecus would really have been sick of us debating how we're here. They're catching deer.
We're catching viruses.
Religion or astronomy.
Descartes or Deuteronomy.
It all started with the Big Bang.
Music and mythology.
Einstein and astrology. It all started with the Big Bang.
It all started with the Big Bang.
From the 2011 album Hits from Yesterday and the Day Before, that's Bare Naked Ladies with Big Bang Theory theme on Rhino Records. Of course, listeners will recognize that as the theme song to the show The Big Bang Theory, a longer version of it nonetheless, but appropriate for our discussion about long time period today. We're talking about evolution versus creation. And I just want to let you know that if you're in the Suffolk County area, Plainview, New York, here in Long Island, not here in Long Island, but out in Long Island, our guest, Jason Rosenhaus, will be speaking tonight. The Center for Inquiry is hosting him in a discussion of his book, Among the Creationists, that's at the Plainview Old Bethpage Library at 999 Old Country Road in Plainview, New York. That's at 7 p.m. You can go to meetup.com/CFI, Center for Inquiry, Long Island. That's meetup.com/CFI Long Island for more information to find out about Jason Rosenhaus's presentation tonight at 7 p.m. at the Center for Inquiries event at the Plainview Old Bethpage Library event. And also, HBO is doing a piece, a special on this very topic. It's called Questioning Darwin. It takes place on February 10th. Jason was interviewed for this piece, and we don't know how much of how much he's in there or not. These things are always up to the editors say and the producers say, but that's on February 10th on HBO, Questioning Darwin. So these are very current debates and discussions. I don't know if Sean Pittman was interviewed, but perhaps he should have been, because he is certainly questioning Darwin. Sean Pittman, what is your response to what Jason was saying just before we went to break?
Well, he brought up a whole bunch of concepts. First of all, that evolution really isn't a mathematical concept directly, but I don't really understand that, because for me, science is based on predictive value and probability, and if you can't establish that mathematically, then you really don't have a scientific theory. What you have is a just-so story. It's easy to tell stories and how things turned from one thing into another thing, but until you have a testable hypothesis that actually produces mathematical predictive value, you really don't have a scientific position. And he also said that this concept of levels of complexity, it cannot be scientifically defined, but that's not true. It can be very well defined, and it's shown that as you move up levels of functional complexity, the ratio of beneficial or potentially beneficial protein systems decreases exponentially. It's an exponential relationship for every linear increase in functional complexity. And also for design flaws, he brought a design flaw argument, and the fact is that as I've looked into these design flaw arguments, like for the eye or for the flagellar system, flagellar motility system for bacteria, they become less and less. There's less and less flawed. And some things that may actually be flawed, for example, the toxin injector that Kenneth Miller uses as an example of evolution in action, called the type 3 secretory system, well, that may be a flawed system because obviously no one wants a toxin injector. But that toxin injector actually is a result of degenerative evolution. It devolved, if you want to use the term, it devolved from a fully formed flagellar motility system. In other words, it requires less parts than the flagellum, and it's been shown in real time to devolve from the fully formed flagellar motility system, and it didn't evolve the other way around. In fact, there's no example of evolution in action in real time that shows evolution, random mutation, natural selection, producing any novel protein-based system that requires more than 1,000 amino acids working together at the same time. In fact, it's really no more than a few hundred. All examples of evolution in action, to include everyone that Jason Rosenhaus mentioned in his book, are all based on small single protein enzymes or systems, and none of them reach even close to the level of 1,000 specifically arranged amino acid residues. And so for me, you brought up the terms micro and macro evolution.
John?
Yeah.
Not to cut you off, but I guess what I'm appreciating what you're saying. Is there a way that you can not summarize, but a way you can, because what you're saying is to some degree somewhat technical, and it's the kind of thing that if you're a specialist as you are, or someone who's read your book, it might be very clear. But I was wondering if there's a way that you could centralize what your argument is, and some of what you say is very clear in terms of predictive value and things like of that nature. Are you saying that? As far as you're concerned, the evolutionary mechanism, as described, shouldn't be able to make complicated beings, as described? Is that what you're saying in so many words?
Yeah, I think evolution is on a spectrum, and it can make simple things. For example, if you want to use more layman's terms, think of the English language system. Evolution can evolve between 2 and 3 and 4-letter words very easily because meaningful English words are so closely spaced in sequence space that you can change 1 or 2 letters at a time and get to a new meaningful sequence very easily and very rapidly. But as soon as you start talking about, because the ratio, for example, the ratio of 2-letter words in sequence space, English words, is 1 in 7, and the ratio for 3-letter words is 1 in 18. But the ratio for 7-letter sequences in English is 1 in 250,000, and it goes exponentially down from there, and the same thing happens with protein-based systems. And what you do is when you do random mutations and you try to blindly find another meaningful sequence, whether it's in English or computer code or protein-based systems, it exponentially takes longer and longer amounts of time. And the only way you can compensate that for that problem is by increasing the population size. But you can only increase the population so far before the environment will not tolerate a further increase in population.
So it almost sounds, if I can just say, respond, to put it in a really simple way as it hits me in the head, it almost sounds like if you saw me with a hammer and a nail and a wooden bench, a child's wooden bench, you could believe I built that with a hammer and nail. But if I then turned and showed you an F-15 Eagle jet, you would not believe I built that with a hammer and nail.
No, I might if you had an engineering degree. It's the difference between you have intelligence, which intelligence are able to skip over these neutral gaps because intelligence can imagine things that can happen in the future. While natural selection can't do that, natural selection can only work with what's beneficial right now. If it's not beneficial right now, natural selection will not select to keep it in a preferential manner for the next generation. And that's the limit of natural selection and random mutations. They just can't imagine what might work in the future.
All right, Sean, Jason wants to respond.
Yeah, I think I better jump in at this point, because I think that this is just not a good argument that you're making. So first of all, my remark about probability theory, was that if you're trying to discuss the long haul in evolutionary history, probability theory is simply the wrong tool. And the reason it's the wrong tool is that if you're going to do any kind of meaningful probability calculation, it's not enough just to say, how many possibilities, are there. For example, you said a minute ago, if you're looking in protein space, the number of functional proteins might be a very small percentage of the entire space. And that's true, but that's not relevant. What's relevant is how the functional proteins are situated in that space. So let me make, as you noted, Harry, Sean, I let you go for a long time. I think it's my turn now. Let me make an analogy just to avoid, trying to get too technical. Suppose you're trying to cross, a large lake like, Lake Superior or something like that. And you might say, my God, there are only a tiny number of stepping stones in this entire lake, that you could possibly use. How are you going to find these few small stepping stones? stepping stones in that huge lake. And then it would sound like you just can't cross the lake using those stepping stones. But if it turns out that those stepping stones are arranged in a straight line, where each stone is reachable from the one before, and then I tell you that you get to start on the first stone, now suddenly it's very easy to use those stepping stones across, you know, Lake Superior. And what biologists are claiming is that evolution is like that second case. It's like, yeah, the number of functional proteins might be a small percentage of all theoretically possible proteins, but most of those proteins have a probability very close to zero of ever happening, and natural selection guides you to precisely the ones that are functional. So you can't just do some, back of the envelope calculation where you say, oh my goodness, the proteins are very, spaced out, are a very small percentage of the space. And that's the kind of thing that's just kind of obvious, right? A probability calculation begins with listing all the possibilities, but also being able to determine how likely each of those possibilities are, and that kind of calculation is simply not possible. But it certainly does not follow from that when scientists devise scenarios for how things evolved, they're not just telling stories. It's not like they just come up with some scenario and then say, okay, my job is finished, I can move along now. No, the point of the adaptationist story, as biologists often call it, is that you can then use that. They say, if I'm right about how this evolved, then I should be able to find certain kinds of proteins in certain other systems, or I should be able to find fossils with certain attributes, and they routinely get results with that. So again, I would come back to my earlier point that, you know, when scientists are consistently, you know, day after day and week after week getting results by applying evolution, they're not going to abandon it because of some hand-waving argument about functional complexity and other, vaguely defined things like that. I have one final point, though, because you mentioned intelligence at the end. You said intelligence can look to the future, and that is certainly true. But I wonder, you know, you're so skeptical about natural selection, and you won't accept any kind of circumstantial evidence. You say, no, it has to be a probabilistic calculation. But suddenly, when you talk about intelligence, you're willing to ascribe to intelligence the ability to do just about anything. But we certainly have no example of intelligent agents creating life, let alone creating a universe from scratch. So when you say things like, oh, you know, the universe or life within it can only be explained by intelligence, I wonder, how do you know that intelligence can actually do that? Because we have absolutely no example of an intelligent agent being able to do anything close to that. So all your skepticism goes out the window as soon as you start turning to that kind of subject.
Well, not really. Is it my turn now?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Sean.
Okay. Because intelligence, let's start with simple things. Intelligence can make things that look very machine-like, or actually intelligence can make machines that look very similar to something like a bacterial flagellar motility system. In fact, very similar joints and rotors and all kinds of things. Intelligence can do that. Nature, on the other hand, has never been shown to do anything like that, certainly not in real time. And the reason why statistics is involved, you say the rocks, it doesn't matter what the ratio is, it matters how they're lined up in sequence space. And you'd be right if they really were lined up as you suggest. But the problem is that actual observations of proteins, the patterns of beneficial proteins or selectable proteins in sequence space, is not linear. They're not right next to each other in sequence space. They have a uniform distribution throughout sequence space, and as you increase the level of functional complexity, the minimum likely distance between anything that's currently beneficial and the next closest beneficial stepping stone in sequence space increases in a linear manner as well. So each linear increase in your minimum distance between one stepping stone and the next closest stepping stone in sequence space, that means you have to increase your average time exponentially. Random walk time increases exponentially with each linear increase in the minimum distance between one stone and the next. And there is no evidence whatsoever that the stones line up like you suggest across Lake Superior. That just doesn't happen. It's not a realistic description of sequence space, protein sequence space. And beyond that, there are no real-time examples at all in literature beyond very low levels of functional complexity, not a single one.
Well, but I'm afraid most of that is simply false. I mean, first of all, the evidence that sequence space does line up the way I say is found by the fact that most mutations, first of all, are completely neutral.
But just a question, though, and we're actually getting to the end of the hour, so we're going to... Sean, we're going to let you get the last word. When you say sequence space, what is sequence space?
I think maybe I can give a straightforward example of that. When we talk about sequences, you know, what is it that actually evolves? We have, it's it's gene, you know, genes that actually evolve. Mm-hmm. And genes are a sequence of you know, four, you know, bases, these four chemicals. So when we talk about, you
ATCG.
So when you talk about sequences, you know, you can model, you know, a piece of the genome as just a, literally a sequence of letters. And some of those sequences will correspond to functional genes that actually, you know, perform some useful function. And, you know, some of those sequences will just, you know, be gibberish that, you know, that leads to a, you know, a dead animal, among other things. So when we talk about sequence space, the idea, is that, you know, for evolution to be viable, it has to be able to find the functional gene sequences or functional proteins, which you can think of it the same way, and somehow stay away from all the other ones. So what Sean is saying is that, you know, the functional genes and the functional protein sequences or whatever you want to talk about are spaced so far apart, you know, in the space that, you know, even if you're standing at one of them, you effectively can't get to the other ones by some small-scale gradualistic process.
So they are crossing Lake Superior in a straight line, but they're 60 miles apart.
Well, basically what Sean is saying is that, you know, to use my analogy, it would be like, you know, jumping, you know, getting across Lake Superior by taking huge, you know, leaps and just like by sheer dumb luck, you know, finding these stones. And what I'm saying is that is just factually untrue, that actually the sequences are sufficiently close together so that it is more like my Lake Superior example.
Well, that's what would have to be true if you were correct, but the fact is that it isn't true. You have no examples of this, and there's nothing in the literature that even suggests that you are correct.
That's flatly untrue. I mean,
that's not flatly untrue. That's the fact of the matter.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, it's just a simple mathematical fact that, you know, to get very large, you know, scale functional complexity is just going to take a long time. So if the only thing
how
you
much
will accept,
time? You can't say, you can't predict because you have no idea how far the stepping stones are because you've never looked at it. If you actually look at how far they are, it's not just a long time. It's trillions and trillions and trillions of years of time.
No, it isn't, because the sequences are not as far apart as you would like to, you know, have them believe. And, you know,
how far apart they are, because you haven't even looked at it.
Physical, you know, things that you can then spew out on a radio show is not the way to do science. But look, since we're getting close to the end, let me make one final point, because these kind of technical details are very hard to hash out on the radio. But I would think, well, yeah, I'd like to point out that, you know, proponents of intelligent design have been saying for years that evolution is going to die of its own weight and that intelligent design is going to revolutionize science and be a new scientific paradigm. And they've been saying this for at least 25 years, going back to the late 80s. But the fact is, the scientists who actually do this work, and this gets back to my original point, the scientists who actually have to go into the laboratory and get results, they use evolution to do that. And they're the ones whose jobs and livelihoods depend on them getting the right answer. So, yeah, anyone can go on a radio show.
Well, look, the only practical science that is based on evolution, like, for example, antibiotic resistance. Antibiotic resistance and things like that, yes, they're real evolution in action, but they're very low levels of evolution.
If you want scientists to take intelligent design seriously, go into the laboratory and do the hard work and get a damn result, okay? Stop with all this hand-waving nonsense, you know, on the radio about functional complexity, which is just so much gibberish.
It's not gibberish because if you can show the limits of evolutionary progress by natural selection, then you can actually make predictions that have scientific relevance. For example, junk DNA.
And why haven't intelligent design people done that? Where are the testable predictions
Jason,
from intelligent design?
Let's let him finish. Sean, go ahead.
Well, junk DNA, for example, for a long time it was thought that it's just evolutionary garbage. Non-coding sequences weren't really beneficial within the genome. But it's long been a creationist prediction or intelligent design prediction that junk DNA, especially since there's more of it for higher level creatures, probably has some sort of function, which has been recently discovered.
So to conclude saying...
Well, it has scientific relevance because you wouldn't make that prediction based on Richard Dawkins' predictions that junk DNA was just evolutionary garbage.
Well, let's say this. What I get from hearing the both of you is that you guys really need to do a tour together. I think Sean Pittman and Jason Rosenhaus would be a really interesting pairing going around talking about these subjects. And Sean, it took us a long time to work out getting you here and getting you on the air because of your schedule, as was the case with Jason. But I'm really glad that we were able to at least have this initial conversation.
Yeah, and just let me say, Sean, it really is a pleasure to meet you and to talk with you. And whatever our disagreements, and sometimes these things get heated, it really was nice to meet you and have this conversation. So thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate it too, Jason. I really enjoyed your book, and again, I agree with Jason as far as the moral issues are concerned. I don't think creationism is a moral issue. I don't think there's a moral difference between creationists or evolutionists or even atheists. If God exists, and I think he does, I think he respects the honest atheistic position as well as the honest Christian position. And if I'm correct and God exists and there is a second coming, I'm sure Jason is going to be very surprised to find himself in heaven someday. For me, ethics and the morality of things are based on how a person obeys the royal law, and for me that's love. If you love your neighbor as yourself, that's what it all boils down to. And the rest of this is just gravy. To me, the concept of creation and biblical value and all that stuff just helps your life be better now. It doesn't really have to do anything with salvation or making you a good or bad person.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to close. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you both, Jason Rosenhaus and Sean Pittman. Jason Rosenhaus's book is called Among the Creationists, Dispatches from the Anti-Evolutionist Frontline. It's on Oxford University Press. Dr. Sean Pittman's book is titled Turtles All the Way Down, Questions on Origins. It's on Pittman Publishing. And you can go to Sean's blog, detectingdesign.com, detectingdesign.com. You can also go to Jason's blog, Evolution Blog, with Jason Rosenhaus, subtitled Science, Religion, Math, Politics, and Chess. Doesn't get any better than that. And again, I want to thank you both. Again, Jason's going to be at the Center for Inquiry's Plainview Old Bethpage Library event tonight, 999 Old Country Road, Plainview, New York. Go to meetup.com/CFI, that's Center for Inquiry, CFI Long Island, meetup.com/CFI Long Island. That's at 7 p.m., so start getting there. Start getting there now. Again, gentlemen, thanks so much for being our guests today on Nonfiction and on WBAI.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And that'll bring this week's edition of Nonfiction to a close. We want to thank our guests, Jason Rosenhaus and Sean Pittman, for their ideas and insights. Nonfiction is a co-production of both the Arts Department at WBAI and of Media Assassin. Read the Media Assassin blog at harryallen.info for news about upcoming shows and information. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. Additional production was provided by Jeff Snyder, Grandmixer DXT, and Harry Allen. Special thanks to Zakia D. McGregor, Kiko Nosferatu, the staff and volunteers at WBAI, but most of all to you, our listeners, members, and supporters, without whom none of this would be possible, and 99.5 FM would be a Neanderthal, just waiting, waiting, and waiting until it evolved enough to run a radio station. No doubt kept back from its destiny by the evil Clear Channel Corporation. Please continue to support WBAI with your donations and gifts. Email us at nonfictionradio@yahoo.com. That's nonfictionradio@yahoo.com. And follow me at Harry Allen on Twitter. That's at Harry Allen on Twitter. Up next, Howard Jordan and the Jordan Journal. For Nonfiction, I'm your producer and host, Harry Allen, wishing you an excellent and blessed week.
I'm Michael G. Haskins.
I'm Bob Henley. This Monday, Martin Luther King Day, WBAI Pacifica will be holding a one-day pledge drive.
The WBAI family will also observe Martin Luther King Day by bringing you the part of his message the corporate media would prefer you forget.
That's a Dr. King that spent his last days on earth advocating for public workers in Memphis. That's a King that warned our nation faced spiritual death if we spent more in the military than on uplifting the human condition.
We will ask you for your recollections of King, as well as discuss how his message continues to challenge us to this very day.
So tune in and help us recommit by recalling the day King came to town. On WBAI 99.5 FM, to the right of NPR on the dial, and to the left on everything else that matters.
The No Spray Coalition Against Toxic Pesticides invites WBAI listeners to a special breakfast meeting, which will feature presentations by toxicologist Dr. Robert Simon and attorney Joel Kupferman on the topic of pesticides are designed to kill, how to use and strengthen New York City Local Law 37 to stop the city's mass use of pesticides. Saturday morning, January 18 at 10:30 a.m. at the 6th Street Community Center, 638 East 6th Street between Avenue B and C in Manhattan. It's free. Breakfast will be provided, but bring along additional food and drink to share. Thanks very much. Wake up, the wicked
witches. On Sunday, January 19th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature trombonist, conch shell player, and composer Steve Turay. Join us as we discuss his career, trombone legend J.J. Johnson, and 30 years of playing with the Saturday Night Live Band. That's Sunday, January 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Climate chaos takes many forms, including this winter's weather. It has many causes, from the way we use energy to tropical deforestation, and has many solutions, too. Tune in to the next Ecologic as Ken Gale goes into detail about climate chaos. That's Tuesday, January 21st at 8 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.